My name is Emily Pingle, and I'm at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I have no relationships to disclose. And I'm here today to talk about a qualitative study entitled Flint Stories of Struggle and Success. So I'll be using the concept of John Henryism as a theoretical lens to understand the path to success and means of struggle among African-American young adults in Flint, Michigan. But first, let me tell you a little bit about the parent study out of which Flint Stories of Struggle and Success originated. The Flint Adolescent Study is a longitudinal study that has been ongoing since 1994, surveying youth in Flint, Michigan. I began working on this study a few years ago with Dr. Mark Zimmerman. He suggested that we might consider one day conducting qualitative interviews with a subsample of the Flint Adolescent Study participants about their experiences growing up in Flint now that they were young adults, approximately 32 years of age. We were fortunate enough to eventually have 14 of the original 850 participants share their stories with us, and this interview project became Flint Stories of Struggle and Success. As we prepared to begin this project, I was struck by the fact that many researchers define the notion of success similarly. Individuals described in the literature as being successful tended to reflect the same common markers of success as an adult. These markers typically included financial gain, post-secondary education, and stable marital relationships, to name a few. Notably absent were things like teenage pregnancy, experiences with intimate partner violence, and incarceration. I wondered how the young men and women from Flint would define success and how they managed the struggles that inevitably come with adolescence and young adulthood, particularly in a city that had witnessed such a steep post-industrial decline. It was at this intersection of the city and the individual that our research team sought to answer the questions, how would you define success and how do you manage your struggles? We conducted in-depth, semi-structured interviews with 8 men and 6 women, all of whom were African-American and residing in Flint or the surrounding area at the time of the study. We contacted the participants via phone and set up an in-person interview in Flint. I conducted each of the interviews in a private office to ensure confidentiality. The interviews lasted from 1 hour to 2 hours, and participants were compensated $30 for their time and expertise. In addition to struggle and success, the discussion topics included participants' experiences growing up in their household and neighborhood, their health, their relationships, their employment, children, and their reflections on the city of Flint. Upon completion of the interviews, we turned to the analysis. We used narrative analysis to consider each participant's personal narrative as a whole while paying particular attention to the ways in which each narrative was situated in the socio-historical context of Flint. Pardon me, I had a sore throat this morning, so... So in the very first interview for this study, I spoke with Lewis, a young man who had encountered various bumps along the road of life. Among other things, when Lewis was 10, his brother was hit by a car and died instantly. His parents divorced, he struggled in high school, eventually dropping out. When I asked Lewis how he would define success, he responded sincerely that if I were to look up success in the dictionary, I would find his picture. Humble in discussing all other aspects of his life, he quickly explained to me that given all that he had been through, the fact that he was alive today, had obtained his GED, was starting a small business, and caring for an infant son was more than he could have hoped for, but that he planned to do much, much more with time. I found Lewis's determination and confidence to be exceptional, especially given the events of his life thus far. But it turned out that Lewis was just the first of what I would come to see as a pattern of strength, of striving, and of goal setting among these young adults, all within the context of intensely stressful environments. I was reminded of the theory of John Henryism and ultimately found it to be a useful lens for understanding participants' narratives of struggle and success. Developed by the public health and policy scholar Sherman James, John Henryism is defined as a strong behavioral predisposition to cope actively with psychosocial and environmental stressors by African Americans of low socioeconomic status. James's research participants in rural North Carolina recounted immense struggle in the face of racism, limited economic opportunities, and little education. Yet their attitude towards this struggle, much like Lewis's, was one of pure determination and unwavering fortitude. Within the definition of John Henryism, we can identify two important elements: high effort active coping and the stressors against which one is coping. We chose to look at both for this analysis. But first, let me tell you a little about Flint, which is a predominantly African-American city that was the birthplace of General Motors. Decades ago, it was a thriving industrial city with a prosperous middle class. In the late 20th century, however, Flint sustained massive losses in the job sector and subsequently in its population as U.S. auto companies steadily declined. As the economic structures which held the city together weakened, residents bore witness to a precipitous rise in crime and poverty. In the midst of these profound changes, the Flint Adolescent Study and our participants were coming of age. Many of our participants spoke of having had one or both parents working for General Motors. As one participant noted, Flint was also a little more affordable back then because most of my generation's parents in this area were working at General Motors then. So they were making, you know, like $50,000, and they were, oh, you know, when you get older, you can get a job like this and you'll be doing all right. You know, well, the $50,000 that they were making to my generation got cut down to $30,000. With economic prospects diminishing across the city, young adults in Flint began to feel the stress of finding affordable housing, good schools for their children, and a job that could pay all the bills. Many narrative strands in this study highlighted the tension between the difficult daily realities of living in Flint and the determination exhibited by individuals to get ahead. I've chosen to focus on Gwendolyn's story today, as I feel that it clearly reflects the narrative arc of John Henryism, in which an individual is striving against gargantuan forces. Gwendolyn grew up with three siblings. Her mom was a single mother who worked at General Motors. Her father was a pastor who was an alcoholic and had abused her mother. Gwendolyn was popular in high school. She was in a program for black scholars, played multiple sports, and earned a scholarship to attend an elite, historically black college in the South. When Gwendolyn was 16, she met her first serious boyfriend. Preparing to leave for college, she discovered she was pregnant and was devastated. She considered leaving her family behind with her child behind with family in order to pursue her education, but ultimately decided it was not the responsible thing to do. On her 21st birthday, she met a young man who promised her a lot. They had a child together, her second daughter, but the relationship soon became abusive. Things became so bad that she drew up a will and made plans for care of her children in case of her death. He eventually relented. Today, Gwendolyn is married to a man that she's known since middle school. She describes herself as very content in her marriage and is glad to know that her husband truly acts as a father to her two daughters. He is a convicted felon, however, which has made it difficult for him to obtain employment. Gwendolyn worked at General Motors for a while, but left to finish her bachelor's degree when she heard that the factory was closing. She's nearly finished with her degree and plans to go to law school. Additionally, she is very active in her church and regularly volunteers at local shelters and soup kitchens with her daughters. As our research team analyzed the narratives, we realized that there were several themes that stood out, namely finding meaning in struggle, a belief in giving back and supporting others, and an emphasis on self-reliance. These three major themes are evident throughout Gwendolyn's narrative. When I asked her how she would define success, this was her response. Success, you know what, I feel my accomplishments, me being a provider for my family. I don't have to be a rich person, you know, to feel like I've succeeded. I mean, me doing what I'm supposed to do as an individual, volunteering, giving back to the community, taking care of my kids, supporting my kids, being there for my husband, continuing being in church is a success, because it's hard trying to live this life, you know? Reflecting on her experience of being abused by her partner, Gwendolyn spoke poignantly of how it had shaped her growth as a person. I mean, I went through a lot emotionally, mentally, and, you know, I hate to say it, it affects my relationship with my husband sometimes. Because sometimes it's like I still got to guard there a little bit. You ain't feeling nobody when you have somebody that has took you through so much, dogged you out, and brought you, dragged you. You know, it's like you have zero tolerance. You know, you tend to don't put up with nothing. It's like I found myself. I ain't fitting to let anybody take it away from me. That's just where I'm at. Throughout her story, Gwendolyn emphasized the importance of her education in defining herself, as well as her pride in her identity as a black woman. When recounting her experiences at her university, she spoke candidly of how her confidence as a woman of color simultaneously intimidates others and fuels her ambitions. My education, God, it means a lot for me, especially as a black woman. Because I feel like, to be honest, like these kids nowadays, they don't know the struggle of just our history, and the schools are getting so far away from it. You know, it's like they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about the racial issues that affect us to get us where we at now. So for me to get that achievement, which I'm still going forward trying to get that achievement, to be recognized as a black woman is so important for me. And so to get ahead, it gave me something to look forward to. And as I said, you're doing something powerful, not just because of, you know, color and stuff like that, but you are a woman. We was like degraded and we had to fight for our rights. And right now, they still don't want us to have any rights. Even, you know, I've encountered a lot of situations where they feel like my voice is too strong, my personality is too strong, like I intimidate. For instance, school is a big one. I deal with a lot of racial tension at my university, and it's because I think they look at it as if I intimidate. My teachers tell me that I intimidate them. Because when I present myself, as far as with presentations and stuff, I am confident in what I do, you know? And I speak highly, and it's just like nothing can stop me. So transitioning back to thinking of these narratives within the framework of John Henryism, what do we know about John Henryism and health outcomes? Well, researchers have written much about how high scores on John Henryism scales indicating higher levels of active coping predict a variety of poor health outcomes among African Americans, such as high blood pressure and depression. Clearly, these are quantitative associations across a population and cannot be applied accurately to a single individual. But I wouldn't be a researcher if I weren't curious about Gwendolyn's health after listening to her story. Here's what she had to say. Oh, my health has taken a turn for the worse, I'm trying to tell you. I was supposed to have a stroke and a heart attack last year. I am diabetic now, and I have high blood pressure, and I take medication for hypertension. My blood pressure is now fine, and now I'm trying to control this diabetic thing. I'm on a pill, not insulin, so I'm adjusting to the pill. I'm counting my carbohydrates. It's just a mind thing, you know? It's like, I'm gonna get off of this. And I am, too. Eventually, I am. So what does it all mean, and how is it all relevant to public health? There are rarely easy solutions, but the participants of Flint Stories of Struggle and Success taught me two important lessons that I believe can be broadly applied in the development of health promotion strategies. First, socio-historical context is indispensable. People do not live in a bubble, and we must therefore make sure to adequately contextualize our data. And second, there's often a divide between those who lobby for structural approaches to improving the public's health and those who emphasize individual factors. These approaches must be integrated if we truly wish to optimize health promotion strategies across the lifespan. So I wanted to thank the study participants and also my co-authors, and just also mention that this research was funded by NIDA, and the research reported here does not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So we've been doing good in terms of managing the time, and we have time. We have about 10 minutes for questions or comments to our presenters. Yes. That's a question for you.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Sure, absolutely. So it's actually a really interesting story that I would have loved to include in the talk. But basically, Sherman James was doing research in rural North Carolina, and he came across this man named John Henry, who was a farmer, and he had worked his entire life in the fields. And he had, and Sherman James was incredibly struck by his intense work ethic and just this notion that there was nothing that was going to get him down, that he was just going to keep going forward. And that was the way that he was coping with the multiple stressors in his life, living in poverty, et cetera. And at the same time, Sherman James is reminded of the story, the mythological story of John Henryism, who I think developed in the 1870s or 1880s, and it's an American myth about right around the time when the steam engine was coming out on the railroad tracks. And so it was like, you know, presaging basically the Industrial Revolution. And John Henry challenged this steam engine to a contest to see who could finish a task that's slipping my mind now, this certain task first. And so it was man versus machine. And so John Henry had this contest with the steam engine, and he ended up winning in the very last second. He won the contest, and then he dropped dead. And so Sherman James found that it was an incredibly apt metaphor for this notion of working so incredibly hard and then experiencing intense stressors as a result of having of the structural burden that is there for particularly for African American populations. So he also did some work among white populations and found that it was sometimes actually protective rather than leading to worse outcomes. So sort of interesting. So we started with 850 participants in 1994. They were freshmen in high school, and then the Flynn Adolescent Study has been following them for 18 years. So I think we finished data collection in August for the quantitative study, and we had close to 400 participants remaining. A lot of people have been lost to follow-up over the years. But we wanted to do a qualitative study with participants who were still living in Flint in order to reflect upon their experiences. And if we perhaps had more time, we definitely could have done more interviews. I would love to do that, to have done more. But in the amount of time that we had to do it, we were able to get 14. And the other thing about this population is that it's an incredibly mobile population. And so they're incredibly hard to track and also to sort of pin down in terms of interviews. It was actually really a fairly difficult recruitment process to set up times with people, and many times people would cancel or there would be no shows, and so it took us a year even to do 14. So that's something then that I didn't make clear. But so those who score higher on John Henryism scales, who have more of that affect of like, I'm going to do it no matter what, they actually tend to have much worse health outcomes. And so her story to me sort of reflected that in the sense that she's 32, 33 years old, she has diabetes, she has hypertension, she's on, you know, the cycle of chronic disease has already in a sense begun for her at a fairly young age. So, okay, cool. Yep.
Okay.
That's the kind of questions that I've been dealing with. Definitely, that would be an approach that I would like to see happening. But also, how we can use qualitative methods to understand better what people have been going through their lifespan, to understand what's going on now. And that's what I'm trying to do right now in Puerto Rico. I'm using qualitative life history approach so I can grasp and understand better the experiences of YMSM so I can understand what's going on now and what is influencing their context, their decision-making processes, and their experiences, particularly with healthcare. Any other questions? Sure.
Outcomes, but they're sort of less embedded in the questionnaire. And it's interesting.
You want to come to the microphone?
I'll just make one comment. I agree with you, and I think that when we say healthier or a lifestyle, what is your lifestyle choices? And I'll just say that in this study, I also had two open-ended questions. One, the first was, what helps you pursue a healthy lifestyle? And the second was, what hinders you in pursuing a healthy lifestyle? So you're absolutely right that we need to be careful with the words that we use, much like diet. If we say we're on a diet, that's negative connotation rather than, you know, tell me about your choices for food. So it was interesting on the qualitative side, the things that they talk about, which of course what helps them is they want to be a role model for their children. How about that? That was the number one. And this article was just accepted for publication, so it will be out shortly. So it was wanting to be a role model, didn't want to be ill, didn't want to have chronic illnesses. They wanted to stay in shape for their husband. I thought that, you know, they had this kind of a body image, but of course, you know, the military folks, the soldiers are in shape, so they wanted to. Where on the side which hinders is much of the work family conflict. They're too busy, they don't have enough time, they're helping children with homework. So anyway, that's a great point. Thank you. I agree completely. Thank you. We've incorporated it in prior quantitative papers that we've done. Anything that you look for, Zimmerman, Flint Adolescent Study, John Henryism, you'll be able to find it. There are multiple papers that use the scale. So we do, I think I want to say it's around 11 items that we use to measure it. So. Exactly. That's absolutely right. I mean, it's sort of a conundrum. And my response to that would be that, you know, we need to back up and take much more of the structural context into account. I mean, and that's where, because I think you're exactly right. It's like you can't say to people, oh, well, if you just wouldn't try so hard, then you wouldn't be so stressed out. I mean, clearly that's the message. To me, it's like we need to remove, the work that we need to be doing is removing the stressors. I mean, the people that I interviewed just had incredibly, incredibly stressful lives on so many different levels. And so I think working on, you know, on those broad levels is really important. And I see a lot of the future of public health doing that kind of work. Mm-hmm.
I thank you all for attending this session. Thank you. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Have a nice day.